This is CBS News headquarters in New York, Alan Jackson reporting. The summit conference that never was fell apart yesterday. Any semblance of a remaining structure that might have existed was blown asunder today by Russia's Nikita Khrushchev in a vehement, vitriolic blast of propaganda put on in the guise of a news conference. This was one of the strangest news conferences ever held by a world leader. The rules of protocol and diplomatic niceties were completely and deliberately ignored. Khrushchev pulled the final props out from under the very idea of summit conferences, which he had worked so long to promote. Tonight, the free world is left to wonder what it all means. What effect, for example, will all of this have on the, until now, faltering NATO alliance? A story on that in a report from Paris by CBS News correspondent Lou Chiaffi.
When President Eisenhower visited Notre Dame Cathedral this morning, a French woman rushed up to him and said, "Be firm, Mr. Eisenhower. You must always be firm." When the president left the Élysée Palace tonight after his meeting with General de Gaulle and Prime Minister Macmillan, a small crowd of people was waiting outside. As the president's open car passed by, there were cheers and smiles in a spontaneous demonstration of respect and encouragement. There was no question that the president appreciated these little gestures in the face of the renewed Russian threat. But what is of real concern to Mr. Eisenhower is how our NATO partners are going to react. Will they cheer and smile? Will they ask the United States to be firm? Or will there be a split in the alliance because of Khrushchev's threats? Tomorrow morning, the foreign ministers of the Big Three will report to the NATO Council in a special meeting. They'll explain how and why the long-awaited summit failed so miserably. And then the member nations will begin the debate, where do we go from here? Informed sources in the alliance indicate they believe that the initial reaction will be what it always has been in time of crisis. NATO was born under the threat of the Berlin blockade. It sagged, then stiffened during the Korean War. In the past few months, NATO has again been showing signs of weakening. And now, once more, the common danger is expected to breathe new life into the organization. But this time, there are some differences. There are signs that one or two of the members may have been frightened. Khrushchev made it clear today in his news conference that any more planes which come over Russia to spy will be shot down. But more important, he threatened to strike at the bases these planes use, bases he knows are located in NATO countries. The two nations involved in the U-2 incident both sent formal protests to the United States. For Turkey, it was just a formality, a diplomatic maneuver to avoid internal and external problems. But in Norway, the internal pressure was so great that the United States now stands a good chance of losing its airfields there. This will cause a serious dispute in the alliance at a time when it should be unified. And that split may even extend to Denmark. Both these countries have always been the least aggressive of the NATO partners. While the entire organization accepted in principle the placing of atomic missiles on their territory, both Norway and Denmark have been emphatic in their desire not to have any part of these weapons. Now they're faced with this new problem. NATO officials think they can avoid a crisis on the basis of President Eisenhower's order to suspend flights over Russia as long as he is president. But again, Norway and Denmark, and maybe others, are expected to balk on another item, a faster rearming of West Germany, which is being hinted at. But these internal arguments will certainly be kept in the background. In this new situation, NATO is going to present a united front, because the member nations are loyal allies of the United States, but also because there's really nothing else they can do. Now back to CBS News in America.
In Washington, the capital not only of this country, but in fact the capital of the free world, diplomats are examining the unsettled wake of the Khrushchev storm. That part of the story in a report by CBS News correspondent Bill Downs.
Western diplomats will tell you privately tonight that Nikita Khrushchev did more than make a fool of himself by his performance in Paris. He also rescued United States diplomacy from a very embarrassing position on espionage and, in effect, restored President Eisenhower's prestige by Khrushchev's extreme efforts to destroy it. For the United States, the shambles in Paris did produce some positive gains which will aid our free world leadership. American diplomacy will now work harder than ever for unity in our North Atlantic and Southeast Asia alliances, a job which will be helped by Khrushchev's declaration of a new Cold War. This diplomacy probably will be aided not only by what Congress says, but what it does. The new East-West crisis will help the administration's efforts to push through Congress the $4 billion foreign aid appropriation. And the Pentagon may be able to reinstitute some of its military programs. Arizona's Republican Senator Barry Goldwater today called for the development of the downgraded B-70 bomber for world surveillance. General Nathan Twining today asked the Senate to restore funds for the Bomark B anti-aircraft missile and for a Navy super aircraft carrier. The true test of communist intentions is still expected to appear first in Berlin. Diplomats here note that Khrushchev today carefully left himself an out and set no definite time limit for signing a separate peace treaty with East Germany or in turning West Berlin into an international city. During the recent pre-summit talks between Eisenhower, McMillan, and de Gaulle, no secret was made of the fact that the Western Big Three agreed to stand tough and ready to defend their rights in West Berlin. Allied sources here say that this included a reported agreement to use force, if necessary, against any interference by communist East Germany, along with a warning that if the situation warranted, tactical atomic weapons, now in the hands of the U.S. forces in Europe, would be employed. It may be that Khrushchev was told of these things before he came to the summit. It would account for some of his rage. But there's no sign in Washington tonight that the Allied tough policy on holding Russia to her wartime agreements on Germany have changed, nor has our determination to remain in Berlin until a democratic and free settlement by the Berliners themselves is achieved. Now back to CBS News in New York.
The next stop for Khrushchev, East Berlin, and talks with communist officials of East Germany. Plans are being made and orders have been given for a huge turnout and rally in support of Khrushchev there. A big welcoming parade tomorrow, a rally, and a major Khrushchev speech on Friday. But the story from that Cold War city tonight in a report from West Berlin by CBS News correspondent Ernest Leiser.
Never have the contrasts between the two Berlins been greater than they were today. In the communist East sector, virtually all radio and television sets this afternoon were blaring the news conference tirade of Nikita Khrushchev. The communists piped the programs in live from Paris, and it was good politics to have your set on loud. In many East Berlin factories, work was stopped, and the loudspeakers in the factories carried the conference in full. And on Marx Engels Platz and on the ugly Stalin Boulevard, workers are putting up even more red banners and Soviet flags than there usually are for the arrival of Khrushchev tomorrow. And except for the harsh red of the decorations, East Berlin today looked grayer and grimmer than ever. West Berlin was at its most pleasant and placid, at least at first glance. There was a summer softness in the air, and the lindens were in full leaf along the wide boulevards which the West Berliners are building to make theirs what they proudly call the most modern city in the world. Exotic models for an international fashion show here were striking poses all over town. And the political crisis did not visibly cut the consumption, always formidable in West Berlin, of heavy pastry and thick whipped cream at the crowded sidewalk cafes. But for all the contrast, the two Berlins had one thing in common today. Behind their different facades, the two cities and the people in them were extremely worried. Probably more so than at any time since Nikita Khrushchev first rekindled the Berlin crisis back in November 1958. For months now, there has been the feeling on both sides of the Berlin line that nothing would really happen here. Now the blow-up at the summit and Khrushchev's hammer blows at today's news conference have abruptly changed that feeling for the worse. The East Berliners are worried because they think that the separate peace treaty Khrushchev is talking about would cut them off even more from the Western world, which for them is represented by West Berlin. They're worried because they, too, see the possibility of major conflict that the Berlin issue carries with it. And even though they don't like their communist system, they relish the threat of a nuclear war far less. The East Germans reacted today with a perceptible glumness and with a sudden sort of last-chance upsurge of flight to the West. Nearly 3,000 people have fled East Germany in the last 2 days. The West Berliners showed their apprehension somewhat less ironically, although the threat to them is more immediate and direct. The stock market dropped sharply again here today for the second straight day. and a handful of people even started getting ready to move out to West Germany. The newspaper headlines, as they always do here, were crying loud alarm. But more important, there was a special quality of uneasiness as the West Berliners read or heard this time about Khrushchev's ranting against the Germans and his statement that it had now become more essential than ever that the Allies leave Berlin. People here have by now become almost immunized by boredom against the constant stream of Soviet threats and warnings. But today's ominous words of Khrushchev, the Berliners appear to take very seriously. Now back to CBS News in America.
At one point in his tirade this morning, Khrushchev said that since he can't do business with Eisenhower, he'll wait until the United States elects a president with whom he can do business. But both Democrats and Republicans were quick to call him on that turn and to emphasize that he won't be able to split the country on that score. The story of reaction around the Capitol in this report from Washington by CBS News correspondent Nancy Hunchman.
Among Democratic leaders on Capitol Hill today, national unity was the byword. This morning, Senate Majority Leader Lyndon B. Johnson released the text of a cablegram which was sent yesterday to President Eisenhower. It was signed by Johnson, House Speaker Sam Rayburn, Chairman Fulbright of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and Adlai Stevenson. The cable urged the president to ask Khrushchev to reconsider his decision to put off any summit conference until after the United States presidential elections. This was noticed to the Russian premier that Khrushchev would get the same kind of a deal from a Republican or a Democratic president. In a further show of bipartisan unity, Democratic leader Johnson made this statement.
I do not believe there is any doubt as to the essential unity of this country. I do not believe that the American people will be willing to do anything other than to be determined to do what is necessary to preserve our freedoms. They're not going to be panicked. They're not going to be divided. They're not going to be blackmailed. The American people, I believe, are determined to maintain the strength that is necessary to survive in a world where a major power has set as its basic standard of right the issue of might. We're not going to be panicked by threats over Berlin or threats against our allies. We're going to continue to operate through our established institutions, recognizing fully that only one man can speak for our country and that he must have behind him the united strength of a determined people.
The Democratic leader on the other side of the Capitol, veteran House Speaker Sam Rayburn, spoke slowly and with sternness. He told CBS News that he felt he spoke for every Democrat when he said that we are for our country and the peace of the world first. Rayburn added, "We have cooperated with the president on all of these matters. We intend to continue to do so until the end of his term." Typical of Republican reaction to the crisis was this comment by the senior Senate Republican, Stiles Bridges of New Hampshire.
It's unfortunate that a meeting so widely publicized as the summit meeting has come to such an abrupt ending. But it's nothing more or less than some of us expected. Because if Mr. Khrushchev hadn't had the U-2 incident to talk about and use as his excuse for breaking up the summit conference, I'm very sure he'd had some other reason or some other basis for doing it. So now the only thing to do is to return to a resumption of the Cold War, so-called. And if we are going to do that, we've got to pursue it with firmness and vigor and make our position known to our allies and to the rest of the world.
There was some pinpointing of blame right now. Senator Paul Douglas, Democrat of Illinois, outlined in detail what he called the administration's blunders relating to the U-2 incident.
While the administration has bungled, we should not allow ourselves to be too much diverted by this, and we should not allow the communists to shake our resolution about Berlin, for example. I think this was the purpose of Mr. Khrushchev's tirade. If we give up Berlin, it would be another Munich. And I hope we and the other allies stand fast together.
For the most part, however, the Congress was trying, as one member put it, to roll with the punch and keep our shirt on. Now back to CBS News in New York.
In every capital tonight, of the non-communist world certainly, the question is being asked of why? What caused the abrupt shift by Khrushchev? Wasn't it more than the spy plane incident? Does it reflect disturbed political waters inside Russia, if not between Russia and her satellites, or between Moscow and Beijing? The CBS News team that covered the events in Paris has been sitting around a table, pooling their ideas and thoughts. Here first is CBS News correspondent David Schoenbrunn from Paris.
This has been a week of anxious question marks. No sooner has one been answered than another, more agonizing question asked. Will K come to Paris was followed by, will he be conciliatory? Can preliminary talks dispose of U2? Will he finally show up after having made his diatribe? Is it really over? And now tonight, the most agonizing question of all, are we on the brink of something very serious indeed? Let's put that question first to Dan Shore, who's been covering the Soviet delegation, and ask him, Dan, would you agree with what many people are now saying, that this performance this afternoon of Khrushchev's is a return to Stalinism?
I wouldn't go so far, David, as to say that this is a return to Stalinism. He did, after all, say that he still is in favor of a coexistence policy. What I say is that if such things continue to happen, he can hardly avoid a return to Stalinism. The statements he made today were such that it is impossible, of course, for him to deal with President Eisenhower, and unlikely that he can deal with the next American president. The statements that he made today containing threats about Berlin, about disarmament, and about resumption of nuclear testing are such that the reactions, if not the statements themselves, will lead him to further things. There is an interaction in these things of which he must be aware, and in doing what he did today, he must realize that he is going part of the way back, and whether he will go all the way back is something that I cannot tonight predict.
What is your guess as to what forced him to go this far, knowing what he's doing?
I think what forced him to go this far was the realization that his policy of seeking a détente was not paying off. And this policy of seeking détente relaxation of tension, as we've come to call it, was going to reach its most spectacular failure at this summit. He knew our positions well enough to know that he was not going to get Berlin. He had a choice to make, and of course, as he does everything, he does it in the most explosive and spectacular way.
Alex Kendrick, you cover the British delegation. They're generally the most optimistic, always willing to conciliate. They haven't seemed to make much of an effort at conciliation this time. This must be a rather crushing experience for Prime Minister Macmillan, who had staked his foreign policy on a series of summit meetings. Alex, just how do the British feel tonight? How do they read what has happened?
Well, they have made a conciliation effort. It has not succeeded, but that has been no fault of theirs. They are skilled diplomats. They've been in the business a long time, and their feeling tonight is that Khrushchev, despite whatever strong language he may have used this afternoon, very skillfully, like the skillful politician he is, left his position, as they say, absolutely open. He can play the game from now on as he wishes. He can either let the dust settle, as he used that phrase, and try again for a détente some months from now, or number two, he can play it hard and confront us with dangerous situations such as the one in Berlin. However, the British point out that even Berlin and Germany were left open as questions by Khrushchev. He did not set any time for signing a German treaty as yet. And the British feel that the West must also be able to play it either way. The British position basically is that whether Khrushchev wants a détente still or not, it is in the interest of the West to have a détente, and we must not forget it.
Well, then they still are trying as hard as they can to be optimistic tonight.
Well, they are letting the dust settle, I think.
Alex, that's extremely interesting to hear, because I've just come from seeing the French. They're putting out exactly the same line. There's nothing to be anxious about. And indeed, they have a fascinating theory. They say that Mr. Khrushchev has been unhappy about what he did. In fact, he had to do it against his own wishes because he's been trying to sell a new policy that war with capitalism is not inevitable, that peaceful coexistence is a way for communism to triumph, that he can get a détente, and as Dan Shore and some of us have been saying, he can also get Berlin with the détente. But then when he came to France to see de Gaulle, he discovered that de Gaulle was not going to let him get Berlin, and that he could not get the new statute he thought Eisenhower had promised him at Camp David. Therefore, he would come to Paris and get nothing and lose face and prestige. Finally, he had this opportunity of the U2 to break up the Paris conference, save his own face, and suggest that perhaps another summit might be held in 6 to 8 months thus postponing the entire Berlin question. A very optimistic view, perhaps wishful thinking, but it's the one the French are putting out tonight. Let's ask now the question of the most important delegation for us Americans, and the one most crudely attacked, that of our own country. Is there any kind of optimism along these lines? How are the Americans feeling tonight, Eric Severide?
David, there is an extraordinary similarity between the official line as put out by American authorities in private meetings just 2 or 3 hours ago and the line that you have repeated from the French and Alex has indicated the British are giving. Obviously, this has been agreed upon just as the communique the other day was agreed upon. To the effect, as you suggested, that this doesn't mean war and it doesn't necessarily even mean Cold War as we used to know it. I think all the officials from the West here are trying to avert any signs or show of panic in our various countries. Steady on is the motto for everyone. The line that our people are taking about this afternoon's performance by Mr. Kay is that Mr. Kay really hurt himself a good deal by his vituperation and the way he conducted this propaganda ploy, and we are told, obviously the wish is to use it, that the president shares that feeling, that Mr. Kay has suffered from his own performance, and that the alliance is now a good bit stronger than it used to be. The American authorities, however, do admit pretty much that it was the plane incident, the U-2, that was the cause for the actual torpedoing of the conference. Without it, and that's been something of a change in their line of earlier days, without it, they think there might have been the conference, but it would have been a failure, and it would have been also a Soviet propaganda operation, but at least you would have had a conference for whatever good that may have been to it.
Gentlemen, we've all been in contact these last few days with hundreds of reporters from around the world who've been milling about the Great Hall and conference rooms of the Palais de Chaillot. We've talked with them. Now, how does the rest of the world look at this Big Four East-West fight? Is this a plus or a minus for us? Dan, how about the East European communists?
Well, I'll report to you what communist journalists say for what it's worth. I don't necessarily subscribe to it. Most of it I don't subscribe to. When they were all horrified in the briefing room when Kharlamov, the Soviet press officer, read the Khrushchev statement, obviously being unprepared for it. They were very quick, however, to present their cover stories meant for Western circulation. And the story that came out, presented to me by several communist journalists, was as follows. Khrushchev came to Paris, all ready to patch things up with President Eisenhower. That was why he came a day early. He expected President Eisenhower to call on him and make an apology and say he hadn't really meant air espionage and there certainly wouldn't be any more. And then Premier Khrushchev would have gone into the meeting. The great mistake, according to these journalists, was the president snub of Prime Minister Khrushchev and not seeking him out to smooth his ruffled feelings.
Well, you haven't heard any denunciation of us by the East German or the other Eastern communists, such as the kind of vituperation that Mr. Kay has been putting out himself.
No, the East Germans the East Germans do on the whole reflect what Kay says. I was talking, I don't want to be too specific, of those who are less diehard than the East Germans in other parts of Eastern Europe. These people on the whole are horrified because they will be the first to suffer from a change in line.
Any of you gentlemen have anything to add to this view of the other side of the world?
Yes, I talked to some Indians and Egyptians, and I think they were among the most badly shocked in the hall because these people who are representative of the uncommitted, the so-called neutral nations, feel that their future, I think, depends upon a detente in the world. Otherwise, they get caught between the two sides. They have been led along through the past year or so with the feeling that the Soviet Union was anxious to help them, was anxious to compete with the West peacefully and economically, but to the benefit of places like India and Egypt. And now they wonder whether they are going to get any benefit from it, and they think they may get some injury from it.
Eric?
Well, I haven't followed the Eastern Europeans as Dan has. I think one thing should be said that however they feel, they were all surprised, including a good many of the Soviet people here. They didn't expect it.
Well, Eric, let me put it to you this way. Just how do we Americans look to ourselves? After all, we've been looking at ourselves. I haven't been terribly happy about it. How about you?
I haven't been happy at all. I wish some things had been done differently, beginning way back when the incident happened. In the first place, we all wish that they hadn't sent that plane at this particular time. My understanding of that, for what it is worth, I cannot possibly prove this, is that the flights went on because Soviet air defenses were so weak, as so many people have said, is the lesson of this, but because we knew they were getting very strong and stronger all the time, and it was urgently important to find out the placement, the location of certain new missile bases that were then being dug. This I cannot prove. There was some warning, as we all know, from our own diplomats to Washington not to let the border flights stray over the Russian border by diplomats who didn't know about the overflights, but in spite of that, this one went on. Well, there's been a whole series of mistakes, as we know. I won't repeat them now.
Well, we've been having a good deal of trouble getting the Americans to give us information while Mr. K is on the center of the stage. Hasn't that been embarrassing to all of us here?
It's been very difficult, but I must admit, the more I think about this, that we haven't had a good enough story about all we could do is let Mr. K go along hoping that he'd have enough rope to hang himself. We haven't been able to get around the problem of the U-2 very, very
quickly. Yes, I think this is typical. We sit here now, we say things about Khrushchev, we are reacting. The American, British, and French governments are reacting to what he said. Nevertheless, the fact remains that for an entire afternoon throughout the world, Mr. K held the world propaganda stage, and we really did nothing to counter what he did today.
All day today and right now.
And the president, I understand, will not make his report to the American people until probably the first of next week.
Gentlemen, we have just about a minute left. Is anybody brave enough to volunteer an educated guess as to what's going to happen next?
I will volunteer a highly uneducated guess. I will volunteer the guess that the nuclear testing conference, for example, in Geneva, the most hopeful area of agreement with the Russians, although it will go on because nobody will call it off, will not get anywhere because Khrushchev has said he no longer trusts President Eisenhower and his agreements mean nothing. The disarmament conference won't even start to get off the ground. It never has. And everything that happens from now on will be under the very chilling effect of what has happened in the past few days. I cannot see it getting much better.
Eric?
I think we're in for a summer of intense propaganda, at least.
I'm willing to wait the 6 or 8 months that Khrushchev said he was willing to wait.
Well, I'm willing to make a very brave prediction that we'll be talking about this for a very long time to come. This is David Schoenbrunn, Eric Severide, Alex Kendrick, and Dan Shore returning you now to CBS News in America.
The question of what next for the immediate future has been answered here in New York. In one form or another, the dispute is going before the UN. Russia's Andrei Gromyko took the unusual step of cabling from Paris this evening, requesting an urgent meeting of the Security Council to consider the matter of the American spy plane. A threat to universal peace, Gromyko said. At the same time, our ambassador Lodge is making plans to present to the UN President Eisenhower's plan for a UN aerial surveillance system to guard against surprise attack. He'll confer with President Eisenhower in Washington over the weekend, probably present the plan Monday. Khrushchev used the incident of the spy plane as the springboard for his vitriolic attack, and yet there was a note of insincerity in his professed indignation over this, a false note that must be apparent to much of the world in view of Russia's own spy activities. A couple of examples. Vice President Nixon said today that 2 Russian agents were spotted trying to obtain secret information in Massachusetts last fall, on the very day that Khrushchev was in New York making a plea for peace to the UN. Nixon also said that there have been other incidents in this country involving Russian spies, but he wouldn't discuss those because, he said, it would expose our intelligence system. Thus, Khrushchev's high indignation about the spy plane had a hollow sound. This is Alan Jackson reporting from CBS News headquarters in New York.
This is the CBS Radio Network,